Welcome to the Atomic Podcast. Whether you're a nurse anesthesia resident in CRNA school or an RN trying to get there, you're in the right place.
I'm Sachi, and along with Rhea, we're going to talk all things anesthesia and science, and we're going to bring along some of our friends too.
Join us each week as we dive into all things science and anesthesia. Welcome to the Atomic Anesthesia Podcast, where we cover basic and clinical sciences and their application to advanced clinical practice. This is Professor Temmermund, and in the next two episodes, we're really going to dedicate to a very critical topic in pain management, which is opioid-free anesthesia and the use of non-opioid analgesics. This is going to be a two-part series, where in the first episode, we will talk more about the pharmacology of each class of medications, including the mechanisms of action. And in part two, we're going to have a special guest, the president from the Society of Opioid-Free Anesthesia, who will share some invaluable information on how exactly you perform opioid-free anesthesia with the doses and how to plan induction and emergence. I know you're going to learn so much from these next two episodes. So before we get started into the medications, why does learning about non-opioid analgesics matter? Well, we need alternative options to opioids. Opioid addiction and overdose has become a public health crisis, making it really important for medical professionals, including advanced practice nurses, CRNAs, and nurse practitioners, to really explore alternative pain management strategies. But besides substance use disorder, opioids cause several adverse effects in the perioperative period, including respiratory depression, hyperalgesia, which is increased pain, bowel dysfunction, nausea and vomiting, and prolonged stay in recovery. While opioids are certainly appropriate for some patients and surgeries, many providers are realizing more and more that opioid-free anesthesia is a viable option for some patients who may be at higher risk for some of the previously mentioned adverse effects. Opioid-free anesthesia must be done using a multimodal approach, which involves using multiple drugs and techniques to target different parts of the pain pathway. By combining various non-opioid analgesics, we can achieve the same pain relief while minimizing the risks associated with opioids. So, in this episode, we're going to discuss the pharmacology of several non-opioid analgesics. I'll put a list of them in the show notes, and maybe we'll make some study sheets for these next two episodes as well. We're going to discuss mostly their mechanism of action and their roles in pain management. The first category of drugs that I'm going to talk about are anticonvulsants. Now, anticonvulsants, of course, were originally developed to treat epilepsy or seizure disorder, but they found a really significant role in managing chronic pain, particularly neuropathic pain. These drugs in particular include gabapentin and pregabalin. They are commonly used in neuropathic pain conditions, and they work primarily by inhibiting voltage-gated calcium channels in the central nervous system, which then reduce the release of excitatory neurotransmitters and dampen neuronal hyperexcitability. Now you may be thinking, there's calcium channels all over your body, including in your heart and your blood vessels. How is it that gabapentin and pregabalin specifically treat calcium channels that are in the nervous system? They do this by targeting a very specific subunit of calcium channels in the central nervous system, particularly the A2 Delta 1 subunit of the calcium channel, which is unique for calcium channels in the nervous system. These drugs are used to help alleviate, like I said, chronic pain, particularly in conditions like diabetic neuropathy and postherpetic neuralgia, seem to be the most commonly studied disorders, pain disorders that gabapentin and pregabalin are used for. Despite its wide use, studies do show that only about 30% of people find relief from these medications, and there are some side effects associated with it. Particularly, some people feel nauseous when they take it, and it also causes sedation. So for people that are taking it for the first time, just be really careful if you're going to do things like drive or maybe go to work. More and more surgeons and providers are giving these gabapentinoids to patients pre-surgery and seem to be having some relief for post-surgical pain. The next category of drugs are actually antidepressants. So along with anticonvulsants, antidepressants are also a first-line treatment for certain chronic pain disorders, particularly also neuropathic pain. Certain antidepressants, particularly tricyclic antidepressants or TCAs and serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors or SNRIs, are really effective in pain management. Notice I didn't say SSRIs. We really need the norepinephrine portion of the antidepressant as well, not just the serotonin. So TCAs like amitriptyline and SNRIs like duloxetine, also called Cymbalta, really work by inhibiting the reuptake, as suggested in the name, of serotonin and norepinephrine in the central nervous system. This typically occurs in the descending pain pathway that your body normally uses to decrease pain signals. This increases the levels of these neurotransmitters, which then enhance their pain modulating effect and provide relief from chronic pain conditions such as fibromyalgia and chronic back pain. More and more providers are actually prescribing antidepressants for other types of pain conditions like chronic migraine. The next category of drugs are actually NMDA antagonists. Ever hear of ketamine? It was first used in veterinary medicine. It became a street drug and still is, but it's actually a very useful tool when it comes to anesthesia and pain management. So pain transmission usually goes from the periphery to the brain through the ascending pathway, and the primary neurotransmitters that are involved in this pain transmission are glutamate, substance P, and calcitonin gene-related peptide. The main receptor for glutamate is N-methyl D-aspartate, or NMDA, along with others like AMPA or AMPA and metabotropic glutamate receptors. If you don't remember the difference between, make sure you go back to that G protein coupled receptor episode where you learn about these types of receptors. Anyway, NMDA antagonists include drugs like ketamine and memantine, and they block the NMDA receptors in the brain and spinal cord. By inhibiting these receptors, NMDA antagonists prevent the influx of calcium ions that lead to the sensitization and the wind-up phenomenon that's associated with chronic pain. Ketamine, in particular, has been noted for its really rapid and potent analgesic effects, making it really a great tool for acute and chronic pain management. The next category is local anesthetics. Local anesthetics, including lidocaine, bupivacaine, ropivacaine, these are all widely used in both the surgical and non-surgical settings. These agents block sodium channels on the neuronal cell membrane and inhibit the initiation and conduction of nerve impulses. They actually diffuse through the cell membrane to the inside of the cell and block the sodium channels from the intracellular side. So by preventing this transmission of the pain signals, the local anesthetics are really effective in acute pain management, particularly in procedures like dental work, minor surgeries, and also spinals and epidurals during labor and other types of procedures. They can be delivered in a variety of ways. So they could be injected either locally, they could be injected like a regional block, a neuraxial, like I'd mentioned, spinals and epidurals. They can be delivered in a cream form, a gel form, or delivered in a patch. Which brings us to our next category. Now, this is not necessarily a drug class, but maybe a delivery modality of pain medications, but that's more topical analgesics. So we mentioned lidocaine patches, right? There's other types of topical treatments like capsaicin. If you haven't heard of capsaicin before, this is the main molecule that's in spicy peppers that gives it its spice and its burn. But believe it or not, they've made this into creams and patches as well. And really, topical analgesics, I think, are really highly underutilized. We tend to just go straight to systemic medications, but a lot of times those systemic medications are going to have more side effects when maybe the pain is just localized to one region, maybe the arm, maybe the leg, maybe the back, and a topical analgesic is going to decrease the amount of medication that is going to be floating around systemically to cause all those adverse effects. Now, of course, we talked about lidocaine, but capsaicin, how does capsaicin work? Well, some of the nociceptors that are in your body, there's many dozens of types of nociceptors, but one in particular is called a TRPV1 receptor. This is also a thermal receptor, which is why you get the sensation of like heat, hotness, but also pain. These TRPV1 receptors become eventually desensitized if you expose it to capsaicin long enough, and eventually they just stop sending pain signals. So the capsaicin can be delivered as a cream or as a patch and are really effective for local pain. For example, conditions like postherpetic neuralgia, and maybe even, we're still learning a lot about capsaicin and its use topically. There are some studies that show that when you take tissue samples, that there may be some denervation that's going on that may be permanent. We still are not completely sure, but something to look out for, that other substances out there besides local anesthetics can be used for topical analgesics. NSAIDs as well can be delivered in a cream form or a patch, which brings us to our next topic, NSAIDs, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So these are drugs like aspirin, ibuprofen, naproxen, and ketorolac, also called Toradol. These are just staples in pain management, especially in non-opioid analgesics. So the research does show that for acute musculoskeletal pain, NSAIDs and acetaminophen are just as effective as opioids if taken around the clock. When tissue becomes injured, this starts this arachidonic acid pathway that eventually leads to the production of this inflammatory signaling. This is going to cause the swelling. These are going to cause inflammatory cells to come to the site of injury. One of the enzymes used in this process is called cyclooxygenase, or COX, or COX. There's a COX-1 and a COX-2. These drugs inhibit cyclooxygenase enzyme and reduce the synthesis of prostaglandins that mediate inflammation and pain. NSAIDs are particularly useful in treating, of course, inflammatory conditions such as arthritis, musculoskeletal injuries, and especially postoperative pain. We tend to keep the ketorolac until the very end because it does increase the chance of bleeding intraoperatively if you give it too early. And you also want to make sure that you consult with the surgeon first to see if it's okay to give. Kind of in the same category, but not an NSAID, is acetaminophen. So to be an NSAID, it has to provide analgesia, it has to be antipyretic, so decreasing fever, and it has to be anti-inflammatory. Acetaminophen is not considered an NSAID because it doesn't have that anti-inflammatory component to it. It is antipyretic, it is analgesic, but is not anti-inflammatory. Acetaminophen is also known as paracetamol, Afirmev, or Tylenol, and it's, of course, a very commonly used analgesic. While it is probably one of the most commonly used, its mechanism of action really still remains unclear. We think that it might be involved in modulating the endocannabinoid system. So this is the system within your body that produces its own cannabinoids. We have a whole episode on cannabinoids and cannabis with Dr. Daniel King. Make sure you check that one out. Acetaminophen is really effective for mild to moderate pain and for fever, and it really does have a good safety profile if you use it within the recommended dosages. Usually in the OR, we're giving about a gram IV. If it's for peds, it's going to be 15 milligrams per kilo, and it greatly reduces the amount of opioids that patients need to use when they're in the postoperative period. So if your hospital has acetaminophen, use it as much as you can, despite the costs. It's going to save you a lot of cost in the long run by preventing those patients from getting high doses of opioids and all the associated adverse effects related to that. Another category of non-opioid analgesics, and I would say that this is more related to spasticity that causes pain rather than treating pain itself, and that is various types of muscle relaxants. I'm not talking about muscle relaxants and paralytics that we give in the operating room to do surgery. Like, I'm not talking about succinylcholine or rocuronium or vecuronium. I'm talking about other types of muscle relaxants that reduce spasticity, like cyclobenzaprine and baclofen. I'm sure you've heard of some children having baclofen pumps for spasticity. They're really going to relieve that muscle spasm and spasticity that is associated with just that constant muscle contraction. Now, cyclobenzaprine really acts centrally at the brainstem, most likely, to reduce this tonic somatic motor activity, while baclofen is actually a GABA B receptor agonist. Now, you may get that confused with some of our anesthetics because they work on GABA A, but these are totally different types of receptors. The only really similarity between the two is they both use GABA, the neurotransmitter GABA, as its endogenous ligand, but the receptors themselves are very different from one another. So the GABA-A receptor is an ionotropic receptor, it's a chloride channel, whereas the GABA-B receptor is a G protein coupled receptor. And they tend to hang out more on the motor neurons rather than being on the sensory neurons. So The baclofen is going to inhibit the excitatory neurotransmission in the spinal cord that controls motor neurons. These are good for conditions like acute musculoskeletal pain and spasticity that is associated with certain neurological disorders like cerebral palsy. Now, if we would give drugs like baclofen systemically, it really can cause high toxicity without getting to its target because it has a more difficult time crossing the blood-brain barrier. It's better for the baclofen to be delivered directly to its site that you need it to work, which is why oftentimes these are delivered in a more of a pump-like modality. Another compound that you may not think about as having a role in pain is actually Botox or botulinum toxin. And of course, we love Botox, right? We use this for all sorts of cosmetic applications, but it does have an increasing role in pain management. This is another type of compound where we're really not super sure how it works. What we think is happening is it's going into the presynaptic nerve terminal and going into the vesicles that hold neurotransmitters, and it's going to inhibit the release of neurotransmitters at the neuromuscular junction and the neuron to neuron, you know, in those synapses. And this is going to reduce muscle contraction and treat certain conditions like chronic migraine, cervical dystonia, and other types of spasticity, which can lead to pain-like conditions. You might hear of people that have chronic migraine that's usually more due to maybe a tension headache. They might go get Botox injections maybe in their temple, in their scalp, their occiput region, in their neck, and their traps. And by causing muscle relaxation in those muscles, you're going to have less spasticity, less pain, and less migraines. Now, the next category, we have an entire podcast episode dedicated to this, which is cannabinoids. Cannabinoids could be derived from the cannabis plant, but we also have, like I mentioned, our own endogenous cannabinoid system, which plays a role in pain modulation. There are two main cannabinoids that come from plants, so that's THC and CBD, and they're going to bind to the CB1 and CB2 receptors. And we go into a little bit more of the mechanism in that other episode, so make sure you listen to that. But this respectively is going to reduce pain and inflammation. Cannabinoids seem to have more of a role in chronic pain conditions, such as neuropathic pain and more cancer-related pain. Research shows over and over again that it really has no role in acute pain management. So giving cannabinoids in the intraoperative period usually will increase pain, not decrease pain. But for people that have chronic pain conditions, cannabinoids may be an option for them. In more recent history, cannabis is more widely used than tobacco. So we have to, as healthcare providers, really understand the effects of cannabis and cannabinoids in our patients, especially if they take it chronically or if they come in and they have used it acutely, how to really take care of them in the intraoperative period and treat their pain accordingly, especially if they're having some type of cannabis-induced hyperalgesia. All right, if you've hung around so far, you're doing great. We actually only have three more categories of drugs to cover. So next we have alpha-2 agonists. These are drugs like clonidine and dexmedetomidine, also known as Precedex. Now, we don't use clonidine as much anymore. You may occasionally see people use them in regional anesthesia by adding them to the local anesthetic. It's really more dexmedetomidine that seems to have more of a utility in anesthesia and pain management. They provide analgesic effects by stimulating the alpha-2 adrenergic receptor that's more in the central nervous system. So these receptors are actually on the presynaptic nerve terminal. And what the receptors normally do is they act as kind of like a negative feedback mechanism. So as that presynaptic nerve terminal is releasing neurotransmitters, the neurotransmitters go back to the presynaptic terminal, stimulate the alpha-2 receptors, and that actually decreases further release. So it's like a negative feedback. It doesn't want to have just this uncontrolled release. And then as the neurotransmitters metabolize and starts to leave the synapse, the adrenergic receptors, the alpha-2 receptors, don't get stimulated as much anymore. And that signals to the cell that it's time to release more neurotransmitter, of course, as action potentials come through. This becomes particularly useful in pain management, So when we give medications like dexmedetomidine, it's then going to stimulate those alpha 2 receptors again and decrease the release of excitatory neurotransmitters. Dexmedetomidine can be delivered systemically, like through an infusion. It can be delivered regionally. And now we're starting to put them in more neuroaxial blocks as well, like spinals and epidurals. Because dexmedetomidine and clonidine decrease the amount of sympathetic outflow from the central nervous system, you could see side effects like bradycardia and hypotension. I typically don't see them when I'm giving an infusion. I tend to see them more if I'm giving a bolus dose. So just be mindful of that as you're giving bolus doses or your, you know, loading doses of dexmedetomidine, that to look out for these types of side effects. Another category of medications that could potentially decrease pain is actually steroids. So steroids like dexamethasone or Decadron and prednisone, these are very potent anti-inflammatory agents. Of course, we know that when you have increased inflammation and swelling, that's going to cause pain as well. Inflammatory agents also make your nociceptors more sensitive. So it's going to lower the threshold for firing. They work in several different ways. So one, they inhibit phospholipase A2, which reduces the production of these inflammatory mediators, such as prostaglandins and leukotrienes. Steroids also bind to nuclear receptors that are floating around in the cytoplasm. And those nuclear receptors are going to go into the nucleus and are going to change the way the DNA will produce new proteins or maybe turn off certain parts of the DNA. These new proteins are also going to be involved in decreasing inflammation. They're really effective for managing all types of inflammatory pain conditions, including rheumatoid arthritis, certain injuries like maybe spinal cord injury or compression, acute gout, and also for acute surgery to decrease inflammation and swelling. We can add them to regional blocks, we can give them systemically, and they're also used very frequently in the OR to treat postoperative nausea and vomiting, although we don't really understand the exact mechanism for how that works. And the last and final medication, or more like a mineral that can be used to treat pain, is actually magnesium. So we know that magnesium blocks the NMDA receptor. So like ketamine, they're actually an NMDA receptor antagonist, which then prevents the transmission of pain. So magnesium is also a competitive inhibitor of calcium. Now, calcium's role is it enters the presynaptic nerve terminal when an action potential comes down, and calcium is going to actually be involved in the release of those neurotransmitters into the synapse. But because magnesium competes with calcium, it actually prevents calcium's entry into the presynaptic nerve terminal, and thus those neurotransmitters are not released, and that's going to be inhibited. This is really often used as an adjunct in perioperative pain management. A lot of anesthetists will give 2 to 4 grams over the course of the case, or maybe in the beginning of the case. And this is really going to help enhance the analgesic effects of the other medications. So that was quite a large list of medications. So just to recap, we went over anticonvulsants, antidepressants, NMDA antagonists, topical analgesics, local anesthetics, NSAIDs, acetaminophen, muscle relaxants, capsaicin, botulinum toxin or Botox, cannabinoids, alpha 2 agonists, steroids, and magnesium. As we discussed, this is such a large, wide array of non-opioid analgesics that are available, and each of them have really distinct mechanisms of action and applications in pain management. We really need to incorporate a lot of these medications into a multimodal analgesic approach and not completely rely on just 1 or 2 opioids to give people pain relief. Remember, opioids are associated with lots of adverse effects, including respiratory depression, nausea and vomiting, hyperalgesia, and prolonged length of stay. Pain, pain transmission, the experience of pain is just physiologically not done by just one receptor. So why are we targeting just one receptor? We need to incorporate so many different types of approaches so that we could hit multiple different receptors along the pain pathway in order to give people the best pain result with the least amount of adverse effects. I hope you enjoyed this episode. This was produced by Atomic Anesthesia. For For more information, please visit our website, www.atomicanesthesia.com, and follow us on many different social platforms, especially on Instagram at atomic_anesthesia. We have a couple of freebies that are on the site, so including the NCEC study plan. So these are for nurse anesthesia residents to help prepare and plan for the upcoming board exam that you need to take to become a credentialed and licensed and registered CRNA. We also have a drug sheet for RNs. Make sure you subscribe to our email list so you stay up to date on all the content that we release, including a cardiac pharmacology course that's coming out very soon. We'd never run ads on our podcast, and we want to continue providing the information to you absolutely free. So it really helps us out if you could leave us a review and subscribe to future episodes. Thanks so much, guys. We'll see you on the next one.